I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Childhood obesity rates in the U.S. have tripled in the last 30 years. Today, one-third of American children and adolescents are overweight or obese and are at risk for serious, even life-threatening diseases. The rates for some minority children are even greater. First Lady Michelle Obama announced an initiative last week to, quote, solve the problem of childhood obesity in a generation. Her program, called Let's Move, calls for healthier school lunches, more nutritious meals at home, more physical activity, and healthier, more affordable food choices in urban and rural areas. She acknowledged it's an ambitious goal, but a doable one, enlisting the help of government, the medical community, businesses, parents, educators, sports figures, community organizations, and more. We're here to talk about the Let's Move program and some of the challenges to tackling childhood obesity are Shiriki Kumanyika, and she's professor of epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and the founder and chair of the African American Collaborative Obesity Research Network. And it's nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. Gary Foster is also with us, and he's the director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University and a professor in the Departments of Medicine and Public Health. And Gary Foster, nice to have you with us as well.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Well, let's begin with the fact that we've got so many young people in this country who are so overweight, and it happened so quickly. Gary Foster, do you understand what's happened in the last 30 years?
Well, I think the simplicity of obesity is that clearly children must be eating more and moving less than they did 30 years ago. But it has happened over a 30-year period, and I think we have to be mindful that whatever solutions we try to take on, they're not going to pay dividends overnight. So we ought to be looking at on multiple fronts, as the First Lady suggests, but to look for incremental change rather than dramatic change.
But you think, boiled down to its sort of most essential parts, is that people are, as you said, eating more and moving less.
Right. That doesn't mean that people who eat the same and exercise the same way the same, they don't. So there's certainly biological heterogeneity in terms of people's responses to intake and activity. But fundamentally, to change the rates of obesity, we need to change energy balance. That is, shift the amount that's going in versus going out.
How do you see it, Shiriki?
I tend to look at things more from a societal perspective. And so what's happened, it's not that quick, but it seems quick when you look back on it. What's happened is that the way we live has changed. And, you know, little things, if you look back to when I was a kid, you know, the things I didn't have, the things that, you know, there weren't any cell phones, there weren't any computers and so forth. And so when society changes gradually and people respond to it, it's not the people who have changed so much, it's what they're reacting to has changed, and it's just made it easier to overeat and to be inactive, and I think that's the answer to the eating and physical activity.
Are people eating more amounts of food? I was actually looking at something recently in the New York Times saying that people are just, and this is not just children, but adults as well, people are just snacking more, for instance, than they used to. Shiriki?
People are eating more.
And food is everywhere, it seems.
Yeah, food is everywhere, and I think when you look at the analyses that have been done, even though physical activity levels are important, in this more recent period, they haven't changed as much as the eating. So physical activity declined from the earlier times, but people have been, you know, sedentary for a while, and now the food intake, the available food is more, it's being marketed more, people are eating more.
And it's just, in a way, that simple. What do you make of the First Lady's program, then, her initiative, Gary?
I think it's great. I think to have someone of her stature to be the spokesperson for such a serious problem with public health implications is fantastic. I think it's also good that it works on multiple fronts. There are a lot of probably good things happening in the country and in states and in local communities, but they're not very coordinated. So her approach to doing things across the waterfront, I think, is really helpful. I think the challenge will come in terms of how this gets funded and also how it gets evaluated. So in some ways, nothing could be more simple than measuring heights and weights. But when you look at a multitude of interventions and of policy changes, I think they need to be evaluated to see, do they make a difference? But I think it's a great start, and so delighted that she's taking the lead on such an important issue.
And what are the public health implications of so many young people, since we're talking about young people, having weight problems?
Well, I think the obvious are the medical ones in terms of increasing rates of childhood onset type 2 diabetes, which traditionally had only been detected in adults. That's clearly related to increases rates of obesity. But you could go down the list. The rates of hypertension are up. The rates of sleep apnea are up. So-called adult diseases that people usually get in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, we now see in kids as young as 5-6 years of age. But in addition is the stigma of being an overweight kid in this country. And that's a tough one for kids, tough ones for parents. And finally, there are some academic consequences. There are data right here in the city of Philadelphia that overweight children are more likely to be absent from school than non-overweight children. The reasons for that are unclear, but there are some implications there, I think, at the academic level, at the social level, and at the medical level.
Shariki Kuminyaka, you are the founder chair of the African American Collaborative Obesity Research Network. Help us. We've been talking about children in general, children and teenagers in general. Talk, if you would, about how this impacts minority children.
We started the network several years ago, actually because of the problem that we saw in African American women who have had a higher levels of obesity for some time. And then the recent epidemic has had a particular impact on black girls, with increasing faster than white girls, and wondering, like, what's going on? So why has this problem been more common in our communities and also in several other minority populations? And then what is it about what's going on now that has really reached into the African-American community and taken the black girls from not more overweight back in the 60s to now more than a 1 in 4 are in the obese range? Wow. And so it's about 10% higher than in white girls. And then Latino girls are kind of in between. Latino boys have the highest rates in boys. And this has been seen, I believe it's at all ages now, and it's been seen for some time, too.
What is the explanation that African-American girls and Latino boys have more problems with weight than their counterparts, either minority or white?
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting, especially that gender difference, which I think people are still giving some thought. My take on this is that you have to look at the same types of factors for every population. So what is it that makes people eat more? What keeps them from being active? And then you look at the social conditions that drive that. And you say to yourself, maybe these social conditions are more powerful, more common in these communities. The way that girls and boys are socialized in different families and different ethnic groups might differ. So maybe boys get out more, have more physical activity in some populations, and the girls are at home. Maybe boys get more food. You don't really know. I don't think people have looked into it. But it's the same factors, but then it gives you a clue. It's how do you look at that population and think, what do you take away? What do you change in order to have a particular effect on the minority communities?
You want to add to that, Gary?
No, I think Shariki's nailed it, that the factors, that the societal factors as she's described them, are the ones that are going to be the leverage points. But how they interact with different ethnic groups is going to be quite variable. It's sort of similar in some ways to arguments about if everybody's living in the same environment, why are some more overweight than others? Could it be biology? Could it be social? Could it be cultural? I think it's all those things. And as Shariki notes, it's really tough to tease those out, but it gives us signals about where to look.
But, you know, and I'm thinking also, we're talking about young people and the problem of overweight and obese young people in this country, but I'm also thinking the fact that, generally speaking, diets don't work. So it's not like you can put the country on a diet, Gary.
We want to go back to Shariki's point, though, about looking at this not just at an individual level, right? So that's the sort of the middle of, or the nexus of where all these factors hit. But it's really important to look at the factors that influence that at a broad level. So, you know, it is important to look at policy issues. It's not putting people on a diet. It's changing the environment in such a way that eating less and eating better is easier than it is today. And I think just from a clinical point of view, when you deal with individuals, it's much tougher for people to manage their weight now than it was 20 years ago, just because of the so-called toxic environment. Now, I don't think that the solution to that is to do a lot of finger pointing, but I think it does say, look, it's the individual, it's a local environment, it's a broad environment, and to look at all those policies at once, which I think is in essence what the First Lady is doing with her campaign.
She even talked about being a working mom and taking her kids here and there, mm-hmm. and realizing that it was probably easier to go through the fast food joint and pick up some food and bring it home than actually to go home and cook meals. And I think a lot of people couldn't identify with that. But maybe this gets back to this lifestyle question and the kind of choices that people have and the fact that fast food is so available, it's cheap. You get that fix of sugar and fat and calories.
I agree. That relates both to the general campaign, I think, and then to the ethnic populations. So some of our analyses of what's been published for food availability make it, unfortunately, all too clear that fast food is easier to access in minority communities.
But I mean, there are lots of fast food joints.
There are more fast food restaurants, and there are fewer other types of restaurants, and there are fewer food stores to buy food. So it's kind of setting a norm. You know, one of my colleagues said that after she started looking into this, she went home, she realized that what she sees on the way home in her neighborhood in Chicago is a series of this. So you're not only getting the food, but you're getting this bombardment of a message that says, this is you, this is what you should eat, this is, bring your children here. And so it creates a culture that this is the way you eat. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the really genius, I think, in the First Lady's campaign is that she's talking to parents and saying, try to be aware, try to see your own culture, which is almost a, you know, you can't do it. Try to look in the mirror and see what's around you and realize that you can protect your children mm-hmm. from it. But then also to talk to the public sector and the private and say, hey, see what you're doing to people. Let's change it. Yeah.
But she also said, and you and others have said as well, is that if you go to some urban neighborhoods or poor rural neighborhoods, you're not going to find a carrot or a head of broccoli.
Yeah, I don't know if it's that severe, but if you think about the way the balance is now, it's harder to find the things that we're telling people to eat. You know, why not shift the balance so that it's easier to find the things we're suggesting that people eat, and then if somebody really wants that other thing, they can still find it. Mm-hmm. We're not taking a choice over it. Now we've got it so that the default, you know, the first option that smacks you in the face, and maybe the second or third, is the one that's against controlling your weight.
Well, let's take a very short break, and I do want to get back to our conversation. We are talking about the First Lady's Let's Move campaign, dealing with the problem of childhood obesity in the United States and some of the challenges of tackling childhood obesity. Shariki Komunica is professor of epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, also founder and chair of the African American Collaborative Obesity Research Network. Also with us is Gary Foster. He's the director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University and a professor in the departments of medicine and public health. Much more to talk about after this short break. Give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. Ahead in the second hour at 11, the story of Henrietta Lacks, a poor African-American farmer whose cells were taken without her permission, launching a medical revolution. Today's forecast, the chance of snow showers that could deposit a coating up to 1 inch of snow on Philadelphia streets, high around 35 degrees. Cloudy overnight, low falling back to 26, and tomorrow partly sunny, Wednesday's high 36.
Next time in Studio 360,
the pressure, make the pressure go away.
Valentine's Day gets a desperately needed makeover.
It's really commercialized, and we've kind of stopped celebrating it because of that.
We'll announce the winner of our listener Valentine Redesign Challenge, and the entries will be judged by writer Elizabeth Gilbert. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking about an initiative that First Lady Michelle Obama announced last week. It's called Let's Move. It calls for healthier school lunches, more nutritious meals at home, more physical activity for kids, and healthier, more affordable food choices in urban and rural areas. She described the rates of obesity and overweight children in this country as a crisis, and says that it's a doable and fixable problem. And we're talking about this with Gary Foster and Shariki Kumanyika, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Gary Foster, let me go back to you. The food industry in this country is something like $1 trillion a year. They make legitimately a lot of money selling food to Americans. What do you think it'll get to? I mean, what kind of role do you think the food industry plays in trying to address this problem of childhood obesity?
I think there are probably two principal areas where they could potentially make a difference. Clearly, marketing works, so it drives consumer behavior, and I don't think that's anybody's fault. It's just a matter of scientific fact. So I think especially when it comes to children, and there have been some good steps in the right direction in this regard from industry, but to be much more selective and perhaps more aggressive, limiting the kinds of foods that are marketed to children. So I think that would be an important step. And the secondly is to continue to develop a company's portfolio to increase the percentage of healthy items. So it gets to be an academic exercise at the end of the day about, you know, how do you define a food healthy? You could spend days talking about that. But I think, you know, most people know the difference between a carrot and a carrot cake, right? So if you came across just some broad categories, calorie portions, and again, there's lots of moves in the right direction here to just develop new products. One of the ways to think about this is for every new product that's developed in a given year, what percentage of those meet a particular criteria of healthy or better for kids rather than, let's say, foods that are calorically dense.
I'm thinking of the investments that have gone into corn in this country, and now when you read just about almost any label, Shariki, there is some kind of corn syrup or corn base that's added to our food. Do you think that's another explanation for why so many people are so overweight in this country?
I have tended not to focus on any one source of calories. I mean, calories are calories. There are cheap ingredients that are in a lot of foods, and that definitely makes it more likely that companies will sell them. But I wanted to add something to this picture of the food industry in relation to the minority populations, because many people might not be aware, or they might realize it after I point it out, is that there's a double jeopardy for minority kids, especially Black and Latino kids, because there's marketing that is targeted or out of balance in relation to the general population in ethnic groups, and then things are targeted to kids. And so the Black and Latino kids are really prime targets for marketers, considered trendsetters, and also heavy users of media. TV watching and is higher, you know, more hours of TV watching. So what I would like to see marketers do for the food and beverage industry is find the market for healthy foods in minority communities, at least to the same extent that they find it in the white community. Right now, it seems like alcohol and tobacco, the ethnic communities are places to really oversell certain types of products, and I think that is a real problem.
Let me add something else to this. This is some relatively new research from the University of California looking at children and TV watching and trying to see the effects of that. They found, and I'm just looking at a piece in the New York Times, that TV viewing and obesity were not connected, but for the children that saw lots of TV commercials for things like sweetened cereals and junk food and fast food chains, there was a connection between being overweight or even obesity and watching TV. Gary, do you want to respond to that?
Well, again, I think marketing works. So if you're more exposed to certain marketings for certain products, you're likely going to be a consumer of those purchases. I'm not so sure that it's marketing more than TV viewing. There's lots of cross-sectional longitudinal studies that would say TV viewing actually is an independent predictor of childhood obesity. So I think that's really a focus to decrease sedentary behavior or the time spent watching TV. But I think people market because it works.
Because it works. And yeah, anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's not just TV now, because a lot of the food and beverage marketing, possibly most of it, has gone off the TV platform. TV is still important, but it's gone into digital mechanisms, the internet, cell phones, and that's a trend that's going to pick up. And so you have to look at the total exposure that kids have to marketing from various sources, and there's some evidence that the level of engagement of the mind when you're interacting with something as opposed to just sitting there watching it is even heavier.
That's
so you're imprinting, even some very young kids, with ideas about what's normal food, what they should eat, with desires, and that's going to be really hard for the average parent to counteract, and even for the person when they want to change it.
Sure, right. And it feels like these ads almost like follow you around, right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They know exactly where you are. Yeah. Let's talk, though, about school lunches, and this was something else that the First Lady talked about. And Shiriki Kumanyika, what do you think the role of schools are in dealing with this problem of obesity?
Well, I think that focusing on school lunch is critical because it's been a missed opportunity for years. You know, the school food programs began with a mission of nutrition adequacy to keep kids from being hungry. And it's still very important to keep kids from being hungry. But now I think that mission has expanded to also model for kids what they should be eating. That should be the best food a kid could see. If the parents haven't caught up, let the school model that for the parents. The other thing that the School Food Initiative does is that it leverages the tremendous buying power of schools nationally and the government to change the food industry. Because if you're going to make big changes and you've got a big purchaser, you could see that the losses might be a little bit less for the industry if they accommodate this big purchaser, and then that has implications for the product development and things that Gary was talking about.
And Gary, you want to add to that? And I've heard people say, "Well, but children are, you know, they like their snacks. They like having the soda machine down the hall. Will children in school eat nutritious food?"
I think they will. I think they'll eat what's there. There will be some moaning if you take out their favorite calorie-laden foods, but kids adjust. And I think in addition to the points that Shiriki made about school lunch and its central prominence in this initiative and in addressing childhood obesity, I think we have to look at the school even more broadly. What policies are there about taking away recess for bad behavior? What policies are there about giving kids treats for getting a good mark in a test? What's the policy on fundraisers? Is it okay to have a candy sale for Valentine's Day? Those kind of things really speak to what sort of role modeling do we want to do in schools. I think schools are critically important because it's where the kids are.
Sure.
So
sure.
It's an institution that we need to influence. And I think school lunch, to Shiriki's point, has not been paid much attention to over the last 20 or 30 years. So I think all of these moves are in the right direction. But I think we also need to go broader than that.
And the idea of recess and gym, giving children, and in some communities, parents are afraid to let their kids go outside and play. Yeah. So school might be the only safe place that children have to be active.
Yeah. Right, but it's complicated. You can see from an administrator's point of view, a principal, if I'm hired or fired or incentivized or not based on math and test scores and I have a fixed budget, am I going to hire a PE teacher or a math teacher? Mm-hmm. So again, these are really complex policy issues, but if we want to move the needle, I think we have to move on lots of fronts at once.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to add that just to bring up the issue of children from low-income families, low-resource families, the food programs are particularly targeted to kids who would be eligible for a lunch at the free or reduced price. There are more kids in African American and Latino communities who live below the poverty line. It's odd that in African American communities, having a higher income doesn't protect from obesity. That relationship where you usually see that the higher income kids have less obesity doesn't hold in African American kids. It even goes up a little bit.
Huh.
But there's still more kids who are obese in the African American community than whites at all the levels of income. And in the Latino population, except in the very highest income group, I think so. Anything you do to improve school lunch is going to have an extra benefit for kids who are depending on it from a free and reduced price perspective. And I think that's a good thing, a good way of targeting your solution.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Shariki Kumanyika. She's a professor of epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. She's also the founder and chair of the African American Collaborative Obesity Research Network. And also with us in our Philadelphia studios is Gary Foster, director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University, both here in Philadelphia. And he's a professor in the departments of medicine and public health, and talking once again about the problem of childhood obesity, an issue that First Lady Michelle Obama addressed last week with an initiative she's calling Let's Move Campaign. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think should be done to address the problem of childhood obesity? Let me get Rick from Hockessin, Delaware to join our conversation. And Rick, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Also, I commend Marty, the First Lady, for what she's doing. But you mentioned Latin American women tend to be less obese than the men. And I go to Guatemala 3 to 4 times a year, live there 20 years, and also Honduras. And it is a social stigma for women to be fat in Central America, including Mexico. It's a terrible stigma, and it was always a shock to us when we would come back to the States to see how fat people are compared to the people we were surrounded by. And it's the diet there. I've always wondered if you took the twins from Central America and left one in the States and one in Central America, the one in the States would outweigh them by 10% at least.
Well, Rick, let me take your point and just see what Shariki Kumanyika has to say.
I think your point is well taken, in that there are differences in across countries with ethnic groups and how the environmental conditions affect men and women, and also in the level of those environmental conditions. Actually, I was talking about girls and the problem in Mexican American, and in data that we have for Hispanic girls overall shows that the girls are less obese than the boys, but that's not true in the adults.
Hmm.
So when you look across the different age groups, you know, most of these surveys are taking a cross-section of people in time. So some of the things you see is the obesity problem moving up from younger kids into adulthood now. There are different social norms, and the social norms in African Americans, for example, don't penalize people as much for being heavy. So maybe if that helps, that's a contributor. But I don't. Mm. I mean, there are a lot of African Americans who are trying to lose weight, and they have the same problems that other people have too.
Garrett, turning to you, and something that the First Lady said, it's an ambitious goal, a doable one, and she would like to reduce this problem of obesity in a generation, in something like 25 to 30 years. Do you think it's a doable one?
I think it is doable. If we could increase the epidemic by threefold, or increase the prevalence by threefold over 30 years, we can certainly reverse that trend. But it's going to take a lot to move the needle. I don't think it takes a lot in any one area. It's going to take a little in a lot of different areas. But I think the First Lady's right. It's an ambitious goal, and it's certainly worth doing.
It's hard, though, to change behavior, isn't it?
Right, and I think that goes to the point that this isn't the time to finger point to parents or kids and say, fly straight, do the right thing. This isn't a matter alone of telling kids, eat this versus eat that. Most moms know what's a healthier food versus a less healthy food, but the economics aren't equal, the accessibility isn't equal, the taste isn't equal, the marketing isn't equal. So we have to change some of those environmental manipulations, I think, to make, you know, the playing field more level.
Let me get Jane from Princeton to join our conversation. Rick, thanks for the call. And Jane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi.
My comment is that in terms of preventing childhood obesity, I really feel that you have to start from birth, and that means more support and better education on breastfeeding and more support from both the public and the private sectors, because breastfed children are at less risk of obesity than formula-fed children. And in terms of changing the norm, breastfeeding is always presented as being best with formula feeding as the normal, but it really has to be looked at as breastfeeding is biologically normal and promotes the development of lean muscle tissue, whereas formula feeding is biologically not the norm and increases the risk of obesity and starts laying down those fat cells that are hard to get rid of. And I think that education has to start even with educating doctors not only to pay lip service to breastfeeding, but how to actually support moms in the hospital and wherever they're giving birth to help get those normal breastfeeding relationships started.
Fair enough. Jay, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Shiriki Kumanyika a chance to respond. Is she right?
I agree completely. I think this preventing obesity in children is an additional call to action for the advocates of breastfeeding. This will have implications for employers, because you need to have that campaign not only for the hospital, but if you look at the countries where breastfeeding rates are higher, women have a year of maternity leave, perhaps. Employers are required. I think New Zealand, for example, passed a law where all employers had to have certain facilities for any woman who wanted to breastfeed. So Michelle Obama's campaign, for example, the Domestic Policy Council, will be looking at this, where in employment, in labor policy, do you do things to help women breastfeed? That's why it's a comprehensive solution. Right. But I agree completely. Breastfeeding is critical, and this is another reason for breastfeeding.
And kind of laying the groundwork. Gary, anything you want to add to that?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get Aaron from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Aaron, thanks for the call. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm a public health nurse working in Philadelphia, and a couple of things that I see is I've read some recent studies on the relationship between fat placement and cortisol levels, and so people that live in high-stress situations have a tendency towards more unhealthy fat displacement, being sort of apple-shaped as opposed to pear-shaped. And also a strong perception in the female African-American and Hispanic community that fat is beautiful, that they're not fat, they're hefty, or they're not even overweight, when in fact they're obese.
Well, Aaron, let me take your call and toss it first to Gary Foster. Gary, go ahead.
I'll take the second point first, in that, you know, there certainly are different cultural perceptions of an ideal body shape, and I hesitate to make much of that in terms of a motivational issue, because it clearly doesn't work to make people dislike their bodies to lose weight. It's just not effective, and it turns out to be shameful. But the reality you mentioned is absolutely right, that there are different ideal body shapes based on probably income, but particularly ethnicity. In terms of the stress cortisol and where the fat's distributed, you're also right that body fat that's distributed centrally or in the belly or abdomen area is much more deleterious, it seems, for metabolic consequences like diabetes and high blood pressure than its fat distributed peripherally. So in short, if you have fat in your belly, it's worse for you than if you have fat in your buttocks or thighs. The relationship of cortisol and that has been shown in several studies, but I wouldn't say that there's a one-to-one link. There are probably lots of factors that affect cortisol, including the ones you mentioned, like stress and poverty. But whether there's a one-to-one relationship, that and the increased fat distribution is yet to be proven. But I think it's a very intriguing hypothesis.
Aaron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Another very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation with Gary Foster, Director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University, and Shiriki Kumanyika. She's the founder and chair of the African American Collaborative Obesity Research Network. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times about tackling childhood obesity, something that the First Lady has talked about last week and launched an initiative called the Let's Move campaign. We'll be right back.
Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY, presenting the Monterey Jazz Festival on Tour 2010, with an all-new lineup of musicians that maintains Monterey's tradition of bringing together veteran and younger jazz artists. The Monterey Jazz Festival on Tour features Kenny Barron Trio, Regina Carter, Kurt Elling, and Russell Malone. Saturday, February 20th at 8 p.m. Tickets available at ZollnerArtsCenter.org.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Coming up in the second hour at 11, the story of Henrietta Lacks, a poor African-American woman whose cells were taken without her permission, launching a medical revolution. Today's forecast, the chance of snow showers depositing a coating to an inch on Philadelphia city streets. Today's high near 35 degrees. Cloudy overnight, low 26. Tomorrow, intervals of clouds, some breaks of sunshine. Wednesday's high 36.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have a conversation about science and faith with openly religious Dr. Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health. Also, 16-year-old violin prodigy Sam Weiser. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And according to the Centers for Disease Control, one-third of American children and teenagers are either overweight or obese. It's an issue that last week Michelle Obama, the First Lady, addressed with a plan called Let's Move. She unveiled that plan last week, and it calls for healthier school lunches, more nutritious meals at home, more physical activity, and healthier and more affordable food choices in urban and rural areas. And we're talking about this with Sheree Ricky Comunica and with Gary Foster, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Picking up on one of these pillars that we've been talking about from First Lady Michelle Obama, and Gary, I guess I'll put this to you. In terms of getting healthy, nutritious food into either poor rural areas or poor parts of Philadelphia, is it just a matter of government getting involved, business getting involved, so that there is a supermarket where people can go and buy healthy food?
I think that's part of it. I mean, I think you have to.
I mean, just that simple in a way.
Well, yeah, but it's complicated, right? There are reasons, perhaps profit-based reasons, why there have been more challenges in underserved neighborhoods. They might be underserved for good economic reasons. But I think that trend is changing quite dramatically. There's an initiative that the First Lady mentions, the Fresh Food Financing Initiative that was launched here in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania and now is spreading throughout the country, that makes an economically feasible model, not just for the entrepreneur who wants to build the supermarket and run it, but also for the surrounding community. So if it can start to make economic sense, and the early data is that it does, then I think that problem is, I wouldn't say is solved, but we're moving in the right direction. I think the other issue here, though, is that, and I wonder about this, if you put supermarkets in underserved neighborhoods, what kind of foods will be promoted?
Well, that's interesting.
If the first three things you bump into were the things that you bump into in suburban supermarkets, it won't necessarily be a win. So clearly there'll be more access to fresh fruit and produce, and that's a fantastic thing. But I think we also have to look at the middle of the supermarket as well. What things will be incentivized, what things will not be from an economic point of view.
And you're saying when people go, and you think I'd know the answer to this, but when you go into a supermarket, you're saying the first thing that people see tends to be the sort of snacky stuff?
Well, yeah, if you think about the perimeter of the supermarket,
right,
you usually don't see very big sales on broccoli and carrots or an inducement or a perfect product placement when you walk in the door. By contrast, when you go down the soda chips aisles, there are big paid-for product placements that drive consumer behavior. It's another form of marketing. So to Shariki's point, if we can start to get to an equal level of marketing for healthy products as we do for, quote, unhealthy products, I think it's a move in the right direction.
And you think that's where celebrities, sports figures, people like that can sort of be part of this campaign, Shariki, to sort of sell people on healthy food?
Well, I'd like to stay with the supermarkets for a moment,
sure,
because I think that selling food is first and foremost a business. And I've visited a couple of the supermarkets here that have been put in neighborhoods that haven't had a supermarket for 20 or 30 years. What I saw is that this is an opportunity for a different type of business person. A business person who has a social interest and has a model that could work. And what I saw in these particular markets is that there's more of an interest. You know, when you see an opportunity in a community that hasn't had a supermarket, you also see the community. So there's been an interest in looking at what kinds of foods the people want. And of course, they're being watched in terms of what they're doing. So I think there's an opportunity there for bringing forward-looking business people to the communities that are underserved, maybe outside even of the supermarket area.
Well, I'm also thinking in Philadelphia. It's true in other cities, but Philadelphia's had this for a long time, these urban gardens. I mean, there are lots when the snow finally melts and we can enjoy the great outdoors and it's warm and you walk around the city or drive or take public transportation, there are just lots of plots where people are growing their own veggies.
And I think urban gardens are wonderful for several reasons. Local food is a big issue now. You know, bringing people closer to their food, having kids know where that something grew.
That this thing that became that thing?
Out of the ground. And also has social benefits. People get a little physical activity. Mm-hmm. And some of the markets are buying from the local producers.
Let me get to Betty from Princeton to join our conversation. And Betty, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I think there's so many things. It's like not that, it's like 150 years ago we came off the land and we went into this society really fast. And all the years before that, we were eating heavier diets because our life demanded that, and those eating habits have maintained. The other thing is that in schools, when they cut the budgets, they cut out home economics, the vo-tech things go down, all the things that physically people need to learn those skills to survive. And if you take things like home ec out of the classroom, then it's like those are basic survival skills that kids need to know for their own sake for time to go on.
Sure.
And if you, like, facilitating a nation by taking those hands-on things away from kids for cooking, mechanics, everything, and it's sort of like the society is, okay, you're good if you sit down and shut up and don't make a mess.
Well, Betty, let me pick up on your point. It's actually something that Gary Foster was talking about earlier, which is, I guess, first of all, the role of schools, but also the fact that, as Betty says here, taking away some of the skills that people actually need to address the thing we've been talking about.
That's right.
Like cooking.
Right. So I think the less families, parents, grandparents are, the less equipped they are to actually make their own meals, the more likely they're going to go and buy fast food, which is less expensive and filling for kids and families, and it's a good economic value. It's a tough one. I think you've got to think about what factors can we ask families to do? So we can change environments maybe more readily, institutions like schools, food, lunch, than we can homes. But I think to get homes focused on one or two key issues, and some recent data from Bob Whitaker just published in Pediatrics suggests that having family meals, to Betty's point, is a really important protective factor against obesity among preschool children. So if we can get the message out about there are some simple things, decrease screen time, increase the amount of family meals, and this relates to the point of perhaps preparing them. But even if they're not prepared, if you're together, it looks like the data show that will make a difference.
Because I can imagine some people listening to this conversation and just feeling badly about themselves, whether they're, you know, a child, or they have their own weight problems, or they've cut corners in order to go to work and make sure that they can, put a roof over their kid's head, and they've had to kind of pay a price when it comes to some of their food decisions. That's what I think. On the one hand, it's an easy solution: reduce calories, increase activity. But it's a complicated solution as well. Shariki?
I think maybe people will become more aware and feel a little bit bad, but they'll still be in the same situation where they're pressed to do this. Many the mom who does the Pop-Tart probably wanted to do a healthier breakfast. We need receptivity in the population for these changes. If we put a store and nobody buys, or if we try to change a school policy and the parents go up in arms, it's not going to work. And so a key here is we have to make people a little uncomfortable with the situation, so to be receptive and to advocate for and really push for the changes that we need to have in the larger environment.
And Gary, if we're talking about childhood obesity, I'm assuming that can translate, or easily can translate, into adult obesity. And just to put a kind of, I guess, dollar and cents on the cost of obesity in this country.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the hope out there is that much like recycling started to happen in schools and kids would come home and say, Mom and Dad, why aren't you recycling? That we're hoping that the same thing can happen around eating and physical activity. So I think there can be some progression in both directions. In terms of the cost, it's enormous. And I think particularly it's enormous because of diabetes. Diabetes is a costly disease medically, but particularly economically. And there's no doubt about the tight connection between increasing rates of obesity and increasing rates of diabetes. And again, think about the economics of this. Instead of having a person develop diabetes in their 50s and 60s, they now develop it in their 20s. There's good data that about 15 years after onset, complications increase significantly. So instead of complications happening at age 60 or 70, like renal failure, amputations, those are going to happen in 40s and 50s now.
So, and that's when people are working and raising families and have this ultimate responsibility in a lot of ways. Betty, thanks for the call. Let me get John from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling as someone who came from a family where, we used to do all of our shopping at, like, the Sam's Club and the Costco. My entire family has been overweight, and actually I was an obese child growing up for most of my life, and not up until, I would say, about 3 years ago, I lost the weight, and I have kept it off consistently, and it's really been because I, as an individual, have chosen to make that difference in my life. I don't blame the grocery stores. I don't blame the marketing that's out there. That's always going to be out there. But I had to personally, as an individual, change my life. And I think that I don't think the problem, as you said, is complicated. I think it's difficult because people have to make choices that are difficult. I don't have TV in my home, for example, so I don't get bombarded with food commercials. I drive an extra 5 miles to go to a Whole Foods rather than the Acme that's around the corner from my house. If my child wants a blueberry muffin, we bake it from scratch instead of just, jumping to the local corner store and grabbing a muffin from a plastic container.
Well, so John, let me take your point, and it's an interesting one, and I want to give our guest a chance to respond, Shiriki Kominika. I don't know, we've been focusing largely on children. He's saying, as adults make choices, and you can't blame food policy or your local store for your weight problem.
Yeah, and I agree. I congratulate John and anyone who's been able to lose weight and keep it off. That's still all too rare. I think that it's not so much blaming the industry, it's recognizing reality. Our lives have changed, and a lot of people are on automatic pilot for various reasons. They're busy, they work one job, two jobs, the kids have to get the school bus at 6 in the morning or whatever. So what we're saying, I think, is that it shouldn't be a luxury. It shouldn't be something that you have to spend so much time doing. Why not make it easier for people? I think that's basically that people will always have to make the effort, but let's make it easier.
And Gary, picking up something that Betty, one of our callers, had said earlier, basically that our lifestyle has changed, and she's right. 150, 200 years ago, we were working farms or maybe working in factories, and all of us live a much more sedentary life today.
That's right, and our life's more convenient. I think we all enjoy personal computers. We all enjoy cell phones. We all enjoy our PDAs. So are we going to give that up? No. But to Shiriki's point, I think we do need to make this easier. And to John's point, this isn't a blame game. We will get nowhere in moving the needle here if we start getting into finger-pointing. What we do have to do is, instead of having people like John who are courageous and industrious and creative and swimming upstream all the time, make that stream a little less tough to swim against. And in short, make it easier instead of harder.
John, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Allison from Wilmington has to say. And Allison, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I love the idea of Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, but as a parent of two kids, I have one in public school, one in independent school, because of the snow, and even before the snow, a lot of the kids are getting what's called indoor resets, which when I grew up was running around in the gym. Now, unfortunately, kids are being thrown into an auditorium, and they're told to sit down for half an hour and watch a movie. I think it's easier on the teachers, on the staffing. Teachers need more planning time now. Kids are also playing card games, and it's just very frustrating to me.
Well, that's interesting, Allison. Let me see first what Gary Foster has to say.
Yeah, I think it is tough. It does come down to staffing issues. It also comes down to liability issues. What can you have 50, 60, 80 kids do in a gym at once that's going to be staffable, manageable, and not get you a lawsuit? So I think those are the constraints that principals work under. And again, I'm not so sure that the blame game is the way to go here. I think we have to think about some solutions. If PE were more incorporated into the school day, we would probably worry less about these isolated incidences related to snow. But it's almost insult to injury. Not only are they not getting adequate physical education in many schools across this country, then when there is an opportunity to do something, it's not taken advantage of, partly probably because there's not enough PE teachers to begin with. So it's sort of a cyclical problem, which does come down to the realities of management and liability and safety of children. But it's certainly a source of frustration for all of us.
What do you think, Shariki?
I agree. I mean, there are some models, Take 10 program, for example, where the teachers can help the kids to move around in the class. They don't get unruly. I think they probably behave better after they have a little break. But, you know, you're raising your hand and you're jumping up and down because you answered the question right. You get that privilege. So some of it is getting the physical activity into the school culture. But the other is, in fact, recess and looking at the potential benefits of being active for kids in their academic performance and the obligation to have the kids move around and not have them sitting all day. So with enough effort, probably the schools could figure out ways to make this work. Right now, the systems that we have depend on being able to go outside, but it's an area that I'm glad Michelle Obama is focusing on. That is one of her four pillars.
And we're almost out of time here, but what do you want next from the First Lady? Not that she doesn't have a full plate with this, but what are you looking for, I guess, is the next step from the White House?
Well, resources are always nice to put some of these programs into action. I think that her leadership in explaining the issues to people, explaining that parents are not to blame, explaining that parents need information, and why the Secretary of Transportation would be involved, or why the economics group, she could be a real good spokesperson for that so that people don't oversimplify.
What do you think, Gary?
I agree. I think the fact that she's doing this and at the level she is fantastic. I think she's appreciated the complexity of the problem and how a lot of stakeholders have to be brought to the table. I think the risk that could undermine a program like this is just a loss of momentum, that there's so many balls in the air to keep this going. So I think she has to feel the public support that this is worth doing. And also, as Shariki mentioned, the fiscal support. In a country that's got some economic challenges at the moment, that could be difficult, but I think to our earlier point, if we don't take care of obesity, it will cost the country in the long term.
On that note, I thank you both very much for joining us today in Radio Times. Gary Foster, thank you so much. And Shariki Komunica, thank you very much as well. We appreciate your phone calls. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program. Also, you can friend us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.